702. 702. On 92.7. And 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
It's what is it now? Tuesday, the 14th of January, 2020. Welcome to it. This is The Money Show, then proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Award for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. So we continue then to get the equity news streaming in this time around. Well, Old Mutual gets perhaps one feather in their cap this time around, as they don't necessarily have to reinstate Peter Moyer, but he may fight the cause. The question becomes, for Old Mutual, would it not have been better to just pay out Mr. Moyo in this consideration? Well, we'll chat to Stuart Theobald from IntelliDex, and he has some thoughts on that one. And it seems Vodacom is eyeing Cell C's customers, a lot of those being contract-paying mobile phone customers. So what happens to Cell C now? Yes, they have a debt pile of around 9 billion rand, but is this really the opening salvo to the end, if we call it to that? And also, of course, we do have the economic troubles that South Africa is facing, and Business Unity South Africa hosting their conference as well in South Africa, and just what it is we can do to fix the situation. Should we be overemphasizing consensus leadership is the question that Musa is asking. We'll chat to Sipho Bityana hopefully a little bit later. And we also have our Heroes and Zeros with Andy Rice, our Africa business focus. And also we'll get to Martha Smith as we talk about how it works, the current status of the legalization of cannabis and CBD products in South Africa. All that and more coming up in this show.
702. 702 for the curious. On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The question has always been whether clinging onto your principles is perhaps a little bit more significant in a time like this for Old Mutual, as opposed to just perhaps paying out Peter Moyer, who you sincerely say should not be your CEO anymore because you've lost faith, you've lost trust in him. But you continue to stand it out, of course, in court, and you finally have a win after getting somewhat of a battering over the last couple of months then, considering that May was when this entire saga started. Old Mutual then suspending Peter Moyer on the 24th of May, then in June, giving him the axe then. And that has incurred a lengthy saga for a company that has been knocked a lot of its share price, but today managing to gain just over 3%. Stuart Theobald, those financial analyst and chairman at IntelliDex, and he joins us on the line. Stuart, as you made note here, clinging to your principles seems to be an expensive one here.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. It is indeed. Old Mutual share price has lost about 12% during the time that the saga has played out. Now, not all of that will be attributable to this saga. There are many moving parts, but certainly the fight with Peter Moyer has been one of the detractions from the overall value proposition of Old Mutual, and has contributed to that loss of value. Now, this is a company worth over 90 billion rand, so 12% loss of value is multiples of billions of rands. So you can certainly see the simple economic case that Old Mutual could have written a very big check to Peter Moyer to make this whole disaster go away, and shareholders would have still been better off for it. So on the economics alone, you can see that case.
Yeah.
However, I think the point of principle is really important here. And one has to think about what the board of Old Mutual is required to do in terms of its fiduciary responsibilities to the company, but also in terms of their responsibilities to act ethically. And if you're a board member of Old Mutual and you come to a view that the CEO should be dismissed, and you come to a view that the company is right to do so, you can't ethically act against your own honest view of what is right and wrong. And in that, from that perspective, I think the board members of Old Mutual really have no choice but to stick to principle and fight this out to try and prove that they were in the right in this case.
Yeah, but this goes on for quite some time. I mean, there's still the secondary matter of delinquent managers then, of course, or delinquent boards of directors, which is a matter that, Peter Moyo has indeed brought forth to the court. How far does this go, though, as a matter of principle, as you made note, but a matter of board construct as well? How does the board sort of move forward with understanding the dynamics of subsidiaries, of, vested and interested parties and, other segments of the business, which are certainly owned by other parts of the employees as well? I mean, NMT is obviously the big reason for this. Where does it actually take them in terms of dealing with a matter like this in future?
Well, one of the problems they've had is they've not been able to move forward with appointing a new CEO for the last 8 months. So that's created something of a leadership vacuum in Old Mutual, and that's not good for the company. The cost to all shareholders has been significant. The relationship you're talking about with NMT Capital, which is a business at the center of the dispute with Peter Moyo, it's a business in which Peter Moyo owns about 20%, and so does Old Mutual. And it is around that company that allegations of conflict of interest were first made. Now, that situation Old Mutual has to manage, and it had already taken the decision that it needs to distance itself from NMT Capital in the interests of Old Mutual. What the board then needs to do is follow through with that intention. It needs to dispose of its interest in the company and recover any money it's owed by that company as well. So that process needs to follow through in the normal course as well. But you rightly point out that there's other litigation pending. Today was just a decision on an appeal against an interdict that required Old Mutual to allow Peter Moyo to return to work. Now, the consequence of this decision is that really the court has said that Old Mutual's initial decision, prima facie, was the correct one to dismiss Peter Moyo. And that's a very important victory for Old Mutual in the whole saga. Now, the other litigation concerns a contempt of court application and suing for damages and so on. Those claims will all be somewhat weakened by today's judgment. I think that Old Mutual might look toward some kind of settlement to put all of this behind it.
Yeah.
But if it does so, it has to always keep the principle in mind. So it can't try and settle saying that Peter Moyo was right. This has to be some other basis.
Yeah, this is still going to have to take some time by the seams of things. Look, Old Mutual doesn't have too much far to go right now with the share price still below 20 Rand a share. So, yeah, it's going to have to end very soon. Stuart Theobald, thank you so much for the time. Financial analyst and chairman at Intellidex.
702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Well, in another story as well happening right off now, Cell C seemingly pawning off its contract paying mobile phone customers to Vodacom of all companies as well. What does this actually mean for Cell C? Duncan McLeod joins us on the line, founder and editor, of course, at Tech Central. It seems that Cell C is pretty much, open prey, or rather being preyed upon by quite a few entities, and, rightfully so in some instances, Duncan.
Yeah, it's an interesting story that Bloomberg ran with this morning. I think they do point out that these talks are very much in the early stage and could yet fall apart. But an interesting development nonetheless, particularly if you consider that the Competition Commission came out late last year with its report on the data services market and was extremely critical of both Vodacom and MTN, and presumably any deal like this would have to get Competition Commission approval, and one has to ask, in light of that Competition Commission report, whether such approval will be forthcoming. You do make a good point, though, about Cell C, and it's very clear that this business is going to be a shadow of its former self once all this restructuring has been completed. We already know they've signed this so-called expanded roaming agreement with MTN, which effectively means they're not going to be running their own network anymore. They're going to become like a super service provider, almost like a super MVNO in the style of an SMB Connect or a Virgin Mobile. There's big stuff happening at Cell C, and I think it's going to be a very different business once it emerges from all of these discussions and the planned recapitalization, etc.
Yeah, so what does this actually mean, though? Does this mean that effectively Vodacom takes on all of Cell C's contract customers, and then Cell C will pretty much be remaining with any prepaid customers then?
That's what the Bloomberg report suggests. We don't know how much those contract customers are worth. It's all speculation at this point in time. I would guess that it's in the multiple billions of rand, which would obviously have a very big positive impact on Cell C's balance sheet, which we know has been the biggest noose around their neck for many years. They're sitting with about 9 billion rand in interest-bearing debt on the balance sheet at the moment, and several billion rand from Vodacom would be very handy indeed in addressing that debt situation. But, you know, 30 days again, we'll have to see where this goes and whether it'll get regulatory approval if they do decide to go ahead with it.
Yeah, it's going to be quite interesting on that front then. It is still speculation, as you note, but as we did also speak, do you think the likes of Blue Label would be willing to offload Cell C in many different parts as well? I know the difficulty, of course, comes with that MTN saga. So if MTN was to perhaps come on board here and make them a deal of deal they couldn't say no to, you reckon they'd go for it?
I think they would. We know that Blue Label and the other shareholder we bought in at the time, NetOne UEPS Technologies, both wrote down the carrying value of their investments in Cell C last year to zero. We know that also that the management team of Blue Label, the Levy brothers who founded the business, Brett and Mark Levy, are no longer involved in anything to do with Cell C. In fact, it's the board of Cell C, as I understand it. The board of Blue Label that's engaging and dealing with the Cell C turnaround rather than the executive management of Blue Label. So my guess is if they can find a profitable way to offload this business, they'll do it.
Yeah. All right. Going to get quite interesting now. Hold on to your seatbelts, folks, and hopefully hold on to your cell phone number as well. Duncan McLeod, appreciated Tech Central founder as well as editor there, joining us on the line.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
All right, so a good day on the markets then. Wayne McCurry, who joins us from FNB Wealth and Investments as well then. It has become quite interesting, though, to note that things have taken a slight dip then in terms of news flow, so to speak, on the international front, because yes, we're just waiting for the signatures now of China and the United States, and Iran has sort of hopefully petered away.
Thank goodness that seems to have de-escalated a little bit.
Yeah.
Because that had the potential to cause, obviously, huge disruptions in the market had it got any worse than what it was. So it certainly, it seems to de-escalate a little bit now. And the signing, I believe it will happen, but I've still got to see the pen hit the paper.
Of course. No.
Because you never know, unfortunately, what's going to transpire. Yeah. Now, remember, this phase one deal isn't big, eh?
It's not big at all. It's not that big,
It's very symbolic.
It's a good start.
It's a good start, and it's very symbolic. But I think this is all we'll see until after the election. You know, okay. I think in any political sphere, this close to an election year, you don't get much done. All politicians concentrate essentially on politics.
Does anything now get done in the United States, you reckon, until then?
Probably not, to be honest.
Sure.
Very little will get done.
Even the impeachment will
get
done.
No, the impeachment will go, but that's going to be one of the major focuses, obviously, of the American landscape. So all attention will be diverted from economic matters by the government.
Okay, well, on the local front, nothing beats Woolworths by the looks of it.
Yes.
I'd still rather invest in a packet of chuckles from Woolworths than the actual share price at the seams of it right now.
Yeah, look, they've had a few problems. Obviously, we know about David Jones in Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just quite frankly a disaster.
Yeah.
But they had also had quite a few issues locally with their non-food side.
Mm.
And then even in the food side, although it's not related to anything they've done, food inflation has been negligible for a couple of years now. It is picking up. So they seem to have sorted out their non-food in South Africa.
Mm.
They've written down David Jones. We're getting food inflation back into the system. It's still low, but it's higher than what it was. So at least they get some pass on to their clients and they get some gross margin from that. Although we spoke to some chaps in our office today, with the drought and the foot and mouth we're seeing now, you know, maybe we won't get that much food inflation because farmers will send their livestock to slaughter.
Sure.
So, but yes, they've still got to sort out what are we going to do with David Jones. I mean they've just they've just opened the new big store that they spent a fortune on.
Yes.
Maybe they polish it up a little bit and sell it. Because longer term, I don't see the upside here. I really don't. Because it's an old-fashioned department store.
Yeah.
Department stores aren't the flavor.
Do you think Ian Moore is staying in Australia somewhat to look after that David Jones business is still the correct move then as well?
I don't know. But they are, if I'm not mistaken, they said that they will be looking for someone to run David Jones in Australia. So I think this is a temporary thing. But obviously the share price was up 10% at one stage. It's up about 8%. On the day, and that's on the back of Massmart doing another 8%.
Yeah.
So Massmart is up 20% in the last 3 months, but it's still down 50% for the year.
Oh boy.
You know, so they've had tough times, and you know, and it's unfortunate, but if you've got loss-making stores, you can't keep them open.
Definitely can't.
Now, surprising enough, the Masscash and the Dion Wired, I think, is only part of the problem. Their true problem is game. So they're obviously deciding they're going to try and sort game out because they haven't put any game stores in this announcement. The
you
true problem is game.
You don't want game to go away, do you?
Yeah, but that's where the true problem is. I don't think game's got its identity. It doesn't know what it is. And certainly the new management there is trying to identify what is game.
So
Bill decided.
Is it a home depot?
You don't know. Is it a fresh food store? But the macro and the builders are actually operating in this environment reasonably well.
Yeah, yeah. I can see how those would perhaps be the ones that sort of want to kind of stay. If we try and brush off and get into some other stuff as well, Old Mutual, you get the sentiment that fine, Old Mutual takes a little win over here. I was talking to Stuart Theobald a little bit earlier and you heard that. Would it have been better for them to have just paid Peter Moyo off a while ago?
Probably yes, but you understand where it came from, exactly as Stuart said. It comes from... They thought that Peter did a questionable deal in his subsidiary company.
Yes.
So in other words, there's morals, ethics, legality involved.
Mm.
You can't just always pay that away.
Yeah.
But certainly they have scored a victory. Look, at the end of the day, Peter Moyo stays or goes, package or no package. It actually, it's virtually irrelevant for Old Mutual other than their PR. As far as the company is concerned, the company's... virtually unaffected by this. I mean, these are massive companies.
Sure.
One person doesn't make a company of that size.
Yeah. So no worry about the share price.
No, I'm not worried. I think there's way better.
Yeah.
There's way better metrics, way better things to evaluate Old Mutual on than firing the CEO. I mean, obviously, it's not good news.
No,
clearly,
of course not. Yeah.
But you know, if we get the equity market going up 20% this year, the amount of money that they will make from that and all other life insurers as well will far outweigh this. And in a year's time, you won't even remember it, quite frankly.
Yeah, actually true. Possibly.
You won't even remember
it. Vodacom taking a hold of Cell C. If this pans out, good move for them.
Yes, but of course, both Cell C and Telkom are too small to survive in this market.
Mm.
I mean, you take Telkom, for example, share price was $100 6 months ago.
Yeah.
It's been down to 28. It's now 31 or 32. Every rand that Telkom gets from its cell customers, from its Telkom mobile customers, 50 cents goes in CapEx just to try and compete.
Oh,
and they're not
wow.
competing. That's why they've got to have the roaming agreement
with
Vodacom.
Oh, yes, with Vodacom,
And then Cell C's got to have the roaming with MTN, you know, because you just cannot compete. So how can you, every rand you get in, before you pay a single salary or a single expense, you're spending 50 cents on CapEx and you're still not coping.
Oh, boy.
So and unfortunately, neither of those two businesses are viable in their current size, the share they got to the market. And that's why Telkom tried to buy Cell C.
Which was absolutely necessary. And it looked like
and now
Telkom,
what do you do?
Telkom needed Cell C more than the other way around. Although
now what do you do? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, very quickly, 1440 for the currency. Stable mark? I mean, it's kind of
reasonable, yeah. Look, 1440 is maybe a little bit weak. Our fair value is, say, call it 14 rand.
Okay.
So it's not far off fair value. And of course, it got to 14 almost a week ago.
Yeah.
It was very close. But so the Rand actually is behaving itself.
Yeah. Wayne, appreciate the time. Thank you so much for it. Wayne McCurry from F&B Wealth and Investments joining us then in studio.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by AXA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. AXA is a registered FSP.
All right, so it is now 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The BUSA, that is, that's Business Unity South Africa, is, of course, hosting its Business Economic Indaba in Sandton, which started off today. Of course, we saw their President Cyril Ramaphosa as well, giving a keynote address as well. And the group seems to think that there needs to stop this overemphasis of leadership by consensus. Sipho Pijane, the president of BUSA, joining us on the line then. Seems that today did kick off very well then, Mr. Pijane. Thank you so much for your time. The question just becomes whether enough can be done as opposed to being said, which is exactly what was done today.
Well, the president expressed, as we all did, expressed appreciation for the focus on implement. And he clearly understood the impatience amongst us as you said, it is a societal impatience with conversations that don't seem to be focused and resulting in action. So we appreciate that, and we think that it clearly indicates that some of the things that we've indicated are implementable with speed can be driven. We are on a common in a common place in respect of that.
Yeah, the hope then would be that, as you say, he mentions implementation, but the question becomes, you know, you say he's perhaps overemphasized the fact that he needs to get a correct or sufficient enough consensus here. Who should he perhaps be leaving out, are you making note of? Or who do you think then in particular he should be addressing when he comes to certain things like this, if, you know, leaving out some of the others?
Well, I must say that we made the point in our statement that we appreciate the president's inclusive style of leadership, which means that he seeks to consult and talk to everybody and ensure that he gets everybody's views on board. But at the point, he must accept also that that might not result in everybody agreeing on what the direction of travel should be. There's a moment, a time, where you then have to take decisions and act on them. That's the point that we're making. So a consensus-driven leadership style is not about not consulting at all. It is about appreciating that you have to reach a point where you act on decisions that you take.
Your biggest sort of notion now and thing that you believe South Africa needs to get done right now in order to achieve the growth levels we need to. I mean, we've just seen the World Bank cut us down to 0.9% for this year. So we're, again, sub 1%. And it doesn't help us any bit.
Well, we've identified quite a number of things. Remember that our conversation was structured around five themes. And those themes looked at what kinds of things can you do to unlock growth in the South African economy. And we're quite specific about a number of those. And they were discussed in great details in small groups with the participation of some of the ministers that were here. And the president sat in a feedback session from all of those. Remember that he was at the funeral of Ndatwe Maponya, so he was not with us throughout the day. But certainly he made sure that he was back with us to get the feedback directly from working groups that had convened and highlighting the key and urgent areas where it might improve our position.
Yeah, I suppose the question, as you said, becomes earlier that it has to go beyond just, you know, speaking about it, and it does need to be, you know, bold and decisive leadership to actually make things happen. Now, would you say then that that's the point as well of the Business Economic Indaba? What are the outcomes you are absolutely hoping for when it comes to the discussion points and hopefully elements that we can take forward then as an economy, as a country, and just as leadership of the country?
Yes, I mean, we welcome the opportunity that the president has extended to us, that some of the input that came from this session is worthy of consideration in the State of the Nation address, which shapes the program for the year of in government, which would be funded, in that it would be find expression in the commentary that will come with the budget speech. So that enables then for all of us to monitor those areas where we've already agreed, as to what extent they are being implemented and acted on. So it enables us to develop a concrete program of action and activities for this year, but we're looking at much more longer-term things than short-term. We all agree that there's no quick fix to many of these, but a short-term intervention that we can undertake that would be mitigative.
Yeah, Sipho Bijana, thank you so much for the time. The president of Business Unity South Africa, they're joining us on the line. Thank you for that. Indeed, we wish you the best still with that business economic indaba. It's enough to have an indaba all the time, and it's consistently what South Africa has without fail. But the question becomes, and obviously all of these are still at the exact same place, Sandton Convention Center, and nothing wrong with the venue, absolutely great venue. But how will the venue finally get us some answers? Will it finally get us to spring into action and actually get things done? A projected growth rate of below 1% as an emerging market. I've continuously asked the question now is, what are we emerging from? Because right now, it seems like we're emerging from the underground and trying to find South Africa's growth levels.
Connect. Engage. Change. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
Just thought before we go into our next interview then that we could just share some quick thoughts then from our finance minister. One would have hoped that after this weekend's January 8th statement then by the ANC, where we made note of particularly where we stand with regards to the South African Reserve Bank and its independence and its mandate and what exactly it should be doing, it seems that the discussion is still going on, even if it is somewhat for the finance minister, Tito Mboweni, on his timeline on Twitter, then just predominantly speaking about that, as long as a long-standing member of the ANC and its leadership structures, I know and understand our resolutions. I don't need lectures on that. But on the SAB, I'm convinced that we adopted a wrong resolution. What do we want to achieve? Our strategic focus is structural economic reforms. As of now, 90% of the South African Reserve Bank's profits are handed over to the National Revenue Fund. So what do we want to achieve? Tell the public. Let's debate. Don't say internal debates. This is a fundamental national debate. Burn me at the stake then. Answer the question. What do you want to achieve by nationalizing the South African Reserve Bank? Don't tell me about internal debates, NECs, etc. What do you want to achieve? Let's answer that fundamental question. That is our finance minister on Twitter. Then I suppose going on a bit of a rant, if you want to call it that, really just with regards to the South African Reserve Bank and that independence. One person who knows quite a bit about the independence of the South African Reserve Bank and what that could certainly do to South Africa's economy and I suppose a sense of stability, Kevin Lings, chief economist at Stanlib Asset Management. Before I rope you in on our actual discussion, your thoughts perhaps on that one?
Hi, Rubili. I think that the minister is exactly right. I don't think it's going to achieve anything, actually, other than further disrupting government finances. I think that the Reserve Bank functions exceptionally well in its current state. I don't think there's any real benefit to trying to change the structure. It won't really change anything. So I think the minister's perfectly on sides in raising it and saying what is it that we want to achieve that's not already been achieved. And I can't think of anything that would be a positive outcome. So for me, I would certainly advocate leaving the Reserve Bank fully independent. And I think that's structural system has served us well over many years.
Yeah, I tend to agree completely. I just think, as you said, we'd have to go to court in terms of litigation as well as to how much is the real or fair value of a price or the price of a share from the South African Reserve Bank, which the, of course, international investors or whatever the case might be would want for it, etc. It just opens up far too much litigation. But anyway, let's move on to the topic at hand, however. World trade then as well declining by what was a substantial more than 2% in the month of October on track to have experienced an outright recession in 2019. This just sounds like South Africa's economy and not just world trade, really, at this stage. But I suppose a lot of it is because of that China-US trade war.
That's exactly right. So if you go back to 2018, world trade was actually growing at just over 3%. And that is the kind of typical growth that you would expect out of global trade. And this is in volume terms. So it's the volume of goods moving around the world. So anything between 3 and 4% would be fairly common for global trade. And that suggests a fairly high degree of globalization and a fairly high degree of vibrancy in terms of global trade. Then obviously towards the end of 2008, President Trump started to introduce the trade tariffs and ultimately the trade war with China. And that quickly became very disruptive to the trade between the U.S. and China, but then it broadened out and it started to disrupt trade much more broadly than that. And while, yes, we hear talks about a resolution and some sort of compromise reached in that trade negotiation between the U.S. and China, you've still got the effect of the trade war. And that effect is really to take trade from a positive or 3 or 4% world trade into a negative for the year as a whole. And the latest number is minus 2.1% year on year. And that's kind of where world trade is tracking. And it's on track in a sense to experience an outright recession. So we're expecting that for 2019, when we total up the numbers, we'll end up with a negative number in terms of world trade. And world trade is 30% of world GDP, so it makes up a huge portion. And that's one reason why it feels like the global economy is under more pressure. It relates to the trade wars between U.S. and China.
Yes, but that hopefully begins to ease slightly, right? Surely when you see pen to paper on this phase one of this trade deal, or is this just because, well, at current levels we have it, you know, at a rate where this is before things had actually taken effect to the extent where we had additional elements like we're having right now?
So it should start to ease up, yeah, as you get any sort of resolution, and as that resolution broadens out or becomes more stable, you should start to see trade numbers improve. And also what happens over time is obviously companies adjust their process. They find other ways to supply. They use other routes. They shift production to other regions. And so there is an adjustment process that is underway. And so I think that this year we would get some improvement in trade. Having said that, though, it's fairly clear that we're going to end up with a residual level of trade protection in the world economy. If you like, Brexit is really part of that, and it's ultimately going to end up being less trade as a result of Brexit. There will be a residual element of trade protection between the U.S. and China that didn't exist before. And it's possible that that is extended, and so the net result is that global trade probably doesn't go back to the levels of growth that we experienced in earlier years, that 3 to 4%, and maybe it settles at something like 2.5%. And ultimately, that's not great for the world economy, and particularly for South Africa. We generally do a hell of a lot better when global trade is quite vibrant. We pick up some of that benefit for ourselves. And we can see during the course of last year, as global trade started to slow, our exports also came under pressure, and clearly it puts a dampening effect on our economy, and it creates more focus on how do we grow the domestic economy and not simply rely on exports. And I think we're going to have to think like that in the future. There is a general pushback against globalization around the world.
The question also then relays right through to agriculture, right? Because we're seeing everything from droughts to fires to just a situation where it doesn't seem like anybody is willing to take on anything else. That becomes a very important phenomenon when you look at food prices, when you take a look at food inflation, food security as well.
Yes, it becomes an enormous factor. So obviously, as we have more evidence of climate change having an effect on agricultural production, and we have elements of trade protection, particularly as it relates to the agricultural sector, we're probably likely to see Much more evidence of food shortages around the world where you're struggling to get supply even out, and much more incidence of food prices spiking as climate change has an effect and as anti-globalization or trade protection has an effect. So from my perspective, the world is much more prosperous when it's more integrated, when there's a higher degree of globalization or integration. You can move excess supply to areas where there is shortage, particularly when it comes to agriculture. So it's not a great environment in terms of the benefits for inflation, and it can end up being quite disruptive, especially for small open economies like South Africa.
Yeah, so it's going to be quite interesting to kind of see how things fare on that front. Hopefully, as we said, the China-US trade war sort of eases things up. Perhaps things get sorted out as well with Brexit. Your biggest fear, I suppose, then, Kevin, over the next sort of year, the biggest notion or element you'll be looking out for?
So for us, the focus is really about how can South Africa find ways or levers to stimulate some pickup in confidence and economic activity. And it's clear to me that the typical levers that a country would use to get out of this very low growth environment, things like cutting taxes, government spending more money, cutting interest rates, those typical monetary and fiscal policy levers are not really available to this country for a variety of reasons. And so we're hoping that the focus switches much more to the importance of policy with regards to private-public partnerships, the role of private sector generally, how the state-owned enterprises are performing. That's going to be the crux of trying to uplift confidence. And for us, the obvious avenue is to push private-public partnerships much more effectively than what is happening at the moment. And I think it benefits both the private sector and government. It can resolve a number of issues, and it can really act as a catalyst to get this economy going. And I don't think we've quite fully understood the position we're in that the economy is not just automatically going to get better. At this stage, it will continue to languish unless we change something.
Yeah.
And I'm suggesting the thing we can change is a much better working relationship between the private sector and government.
If only they would listen to each other and actually get things done. Kevin Lings, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the time. Kevin Lings is chief economist at Stanlib Asset Management, joining us there to unpack that trade picture a little bit. And hopefully heading into this year, things don't get any worse before they get any better.
702 on 92.7 and 106 FM. Streaming on 702.co.za, the 702 app, and on DSTV channel 856.
So we get into the second half of The Money Show, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Award for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. My name is Arabile Komete, indeed, standing in for Bruce Whitfield. As we get into the second half of the show, we get into our regular features, the heroes and zeros. Of course, Andy Rice joining us in studio then as we get into this, branding and advertising expert. Andy, you have a hero for us this week.
Yes, good evening, Arabile. Nice to see you. This is a story about consumer power and listening to your market. Are you a breakfast cereal man?
Yeah, not necessarily. So I kind of, I'll call it dabble in it from time to time.
Well, I'm a bit of a cereal enthusiast. I mean, you said cereal killer. I'm a cereal enthusiast.
You kill the cereal, let's put it that way.
And one of the particular brands from my youth is Rice Krispies. And they were a big favorite here for many years. And then 2 years ago, or a little less, Kellogg, the owner of the Rice Krispies brand, changed the formulation drastically. In fact, I'm surprised it's still called Rice Krispies, because I don't think that rice is a key element anymore of the product. And there was like a customer revolt, and people said, I'm not interested in this new product, and switched either to another Kellogg product, or worse for Kellogg, to another company's brand. But they listened. That's the good news. And that's why this particular case study could really have been a zero or a hero. But we're making it a hero because Kellogg's listened to what was going on out there, listened to the complaints that were coming through, realized they had underestimated the negative impact of, on the one hand, discontinuing a favorite, and on the other hand, introducing an alternative which seemed to be rather less popular, much more sugar content in this age of trying to cut back on sugar. And although they claim that they did a lot of research into customer preferences, taste tests, that kind of stuff, the thing that they failed to recognize is there's a difference between doing taste tests in a artificial commercial business environment and doing them at 7:30 in the morning when your 10-year-old is saying, what's for breakfast? And that's where the truth is really emerges. And clearly that's what happened here. And Kellogg, to their credit, perhaps they took a leaf out of Coca-Cola's book, the famous case study of New Coke back in 1985 when they changed the formula. And that was still to this day a case study that people quote. They apparently had done 200,000 taste tests on the New Coke formula. And despite that, they were taken to the cleaners by the market. And so now we have a situation where Kellogg have said, okay, we'll bring the original Rice Krispies back to South Africa.
How long did that take, though? How long was that entire process?
Yeah, it's been over a year. Obviously, Rice Krispies is not quite as big a brand as a Coca-Cola, who backtracked on their decision after just 79 days. So this was a slower process. But I think the important thing is that the manufacturer was recalled and persuaded that the customer is king. And if they say they don't like it, no amount of marketing is going to make a difference.
Mm.
And certainly in my own household, Rice Krispies disappeared completely from the...
Is it coming back now after this?
It's now coming back. It's going to be more expensive because it's imported.
So is it coming back to your household? This is also the question.
Well, yes, we'll see. I think it might. But anyway, as a case study in marketing and understanding customer preferences, I think hats off to Kellogg for having the courage really to say, okay, we admit we were wrong. We'll bring in the new variant under the original Rice Krispies banner, and we'll be able to keep the new one as well. And we'll see.
Yeah, as you said, though, this could have literally have been a hero or a zero, really, in this case. But in that case, you have, however, selected a zero, though.
I have. I've just come back from a few days in Maputo. And even though that's just outside of South Africa's borders in Mozambique, you get almost a completely different television programming bouquet in the hotel rooms. Mm. And it's all under DSTV banner mainly. But you don't find the originals so easily. And so I found myself surfing through looking for something to get a particular news perspective and fell upon CNN. Although we have CNN here, I suspect that the advertising content differs the moment you reach the border. And I was hooked. The advertising is very different. It's mainly business to business, or it's about tourism to different countries promoting their country brands.
Yeah.
And there was some really quite weird stuff. So I just want to play the audio of a track, the audio track of a commercial that I saw a number of times on CNN.
There are all kinds of smiles. The everything will be fine smile. The my daddy is the best smile. The I am blessed smile. The caught you smile. The not a care in the world smile. And the wish I were a child smile. Kirloska, behind a million smiles.
Well, Arabile, what product category do you think that was for?
I mean, that could be toothpaste for all I know.
Exactly, could be toothpaste. It could be fast food. It could be Valium. It could be anything where the concept of behind a million smiles makes sense. Except this is not for any of those. This is for a company. You heard the name briefly there. Kirloska, behind a million smiles. They make refrigeration, engine and transmission castings, pumps and generators. And I'm a great fan of bringing an emotional hook into advertising and not being totally rational about things. So on the one hand, I applaud them for going outside of the normal engineering space when it comes to advertising. But the incongruity to me of that piece of very soppy emotional advertising for a company that's selling something as hard-bitten and as away from the norm as engine and transmission castings, that just seems a little bit of a bridge too far to understand the link between the two. And I have a slightly cynical theory that people who spend, brands who spend large amounts of money on television commercials, on producing them, occasionally try to get some of them back, some of that investment back by making the commercial available to others to use, to rebrand. And this looks like something that's come out of a toothpaste category in a far-flung corner of the world. And with a quick bit of branding and a voiceover, suddenly we have an engineering commercial.
Yeah, but just lend it out to P&G or somebody and they'll definitely grab onto it. Right?
Or buy it from P&G, one or the other.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was such incongruity that I really couldn't see any merit in going that route for a company that's marketing and selling those kind of products.
You made note of the emotive, you know, notion in trying to sell a product or perhaps creating kind of the sense of wanting or desiring the product when you create that emotive notion. How does one do it right, though, I suppose, for future reference?
I think you just look into your anthropological textbooks and say, now what matters for human beings, because the idea of bringing in emotion is much more accurate in terms of reflecting the customer experience and the customer process of going about buying anything. There is an element of emotive potential in every category. It's just not quite, this is taking that principle too far in my opinion, to the point where it's no longer the critical aspects of relevance and credibility in advertising. If a customer doesn't see the relevance of this approach and doesn't find it credible, then I think you've got a weak piece of advertising, and I'm afraid this is what I think this is.
Andy Rice, appreciate the time. Thank you so much. First one of the new year. That's your heroes and zeros then to kick off 2020. Thank you so much for that. Really appreciate it. Branding and advertising expert there. That's Andy Rice.
The Africa Business Report.
It's 20 past 7. The name is Arabile Kumete. Still standing in, of course, for Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show. He is back, of course, then tomorrow. But for now, we get into that Africa business focus. Ronak Kapeldasa is the director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk, and he joins us in studio. Ronak, Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Arabile. Great to see you.
All right, so we head off into the vastness that is Africa. But to kick things off, as Britain, or as, you know, the United Kingdom sort of goes through this whole Brexit situation, they're going to have to try and find allies. They think that Africa could be perhaps a part of that process somewhat as they go to that UK-Africa summit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the UK-Africa summit is next week. You know, in the past couple of months, the UK has been preoccupied with its election, still dealing with Brexit, and now Megxit. So this is a welcome distraction for them. And what's quite interesting is how they're positioning themselves in this conference. So they're trying to look for a partnership of equals. It's less focused on kind of political influence and political power, more around the financial incentives. And for advocates of Brexit, this is an opportunity to showcase global Britain and to see how it markets itself in a post-European Union world. Mm. Now, this is quite interesting in the sense that, you know, critics will argue that it's going to be little Britain, but they're pushing this kind of agenda focused on trade, on tech and investment. And the African continent needs a strong Western partner. You know, it's not new that Africa has been courted by a number of countries. We had the Russia-Africa summit. We had the Chinese-Africa summit, FOCAC. So I guess for me, the big question is how this is going to be played. Will
what's
Africa
so different here, I suppose? And what's the kind of exact offering? As you said, yes, Africa does need a solid sort of Western power. But as you said, little Britain is perhaps the case in point here. Is it still a case of pure equals, do you reckon, though?
So that's what is going to be interesting to observe, because there'll be a lot of pomp and pageantry, symbolism, a lot of big ticket announcements and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, the colonial hangover is something that the UK really needs to work to address in terms of its imaging. So it will need to kind of put forward this partnership of equals, win-win cooperation and situations. You know, it's got a number of distinct advantages, the diaspora, the Commonwealth ties, the historical links towards the continent. So, you know, how it leverages that and kind of, you know, if it's the Empire 2.0, it's not going to work. So it really does need to be a case of we understand, we listen, and we're here to be mutually beneficial and to create win-win situations.
Yeah, so that's going to happen out of course in Birmingham and of course in London as well, as you said, just what's that, next week if I'm not mistaken? Mm-hmm.
The 20th.
Yeah, the 20th. Okay. The next one, well, West Africa getting a few changes here, and this time around it's the currency. Look, they already have the BRVM for certain parts of West Africa, right, as a trading exchange. This new currency could certainly change things as well.
Yeah, so last year Emmanuel Macron visited West Africa, and he held a summit with Alassane Ouattara, who's the leader of Côte d'Ivoire,
yeah.
And they announced that the CFA franc would no longer exist, and it would be replaced by the ECO for the West African Economic and Monetary Union member states. Now, there was a lot of fanfare around that, but the big question is, does anything really change? Mm. Is it cosmetic? Is it a rebrand? Or is there a fundamental shift? Now, this has been a topic that's generated a lot of controversy, because the proponents of it will say that it gives you price stability, it gives you monetary policy credibility. The critics will say that actually these countries are kind of ring-fenced by this colonial mechanism. Mm. They don't have sovereignty, and this is very patronizing. So I think if you look at what's actually happened, the currency has got a new name. The countries in question no longer have to hold 50% of their reserves with the French Treasury. And the French have stepped back from the institutional and governance mechanisms around monetary policy. However, the currency is still pegged to the euro, and the convertibility of the currency is still guaranteed by the Bank of France. So in reality, it's more around the kind of political optics, quelling some of the anti-French sentiment. You know, in an era of nationalism and populism, this boosts some political capital, but economically, I don't think that much changes, but we'll wait.
Is it not maybe a starting point? Is it not maybe a starting point to say, okay, this is where we're at, and we'll give you as much as possible, then we'll hold on to perhaps a little bit in some way, and then, hopefully gradually over time we'll begin to get some more.
Perhaps. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, we know that there's a broader agenda to kind of launch the ECHO in the broader ECOWAS community, so maybe this is a precursor to that, but the coordination around fiscal and monetary policy and the convergence criteria there is going to be quite important, given the size of Nigeria's economy especially, and the lessons that we've learned from the Eurozone. So we'll have to wait and see. Cynics will say it's just kind of an optical illusion. Some of the more optimistic folks will say that this is the start of self-determination.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move just within South Africa's borders somewhat, Lesotho as well then, an interesting one, not so far away. The political drama there, boy oh boy, it's out of a soapy drama, really. Yeah.
I mean, it's always been politically turbulent, but even by its own standards, the recent episode is something that raises eyebrows. Yeah. So, what's happened is that the High Court has issued an arrest warrant for the First Lady, and it relates to the killing of the current Prime Minister's ex-wife a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He's also implicated in this, but to date, nobody's been arrested. Obviously, like all good soap operas, there's a backstory, right? And the issue kind of stems from the factional battles within the ruling party. There was a tiff between the police commissioner and the prime minister, which has escalated quite dramatically. The police commissioner was going to be dismissed by the prime minister, and he hit back with these kind of unsavory allegations. So that's something that we're going to need to wait and see how it plays out. There's factionalism within the ruling party. The prime minister has got a target on his back. There's been kind of splinter groups and breakaways, and the political drama in Lesotho continues.
Yeah, so just about who gets arrested, who doesn't, one is in the wind as well, and just where to find the other, it just gets so complicated, as you make note there, Ronak. Hopefully we'll get a gist of where things are going on that front. You've called the next one sort of Morocco's Africa pivot. Why?
Yeah, Morocco is interesting because for a long time it didn't really embrace its African identity. Even though geographically it was situated within Africa, it identified because of the proximity more towards Europe, culturally obviously more related to the Middle East, and it actually tried to join the European Union not so long ago. Left the African Union and then was readmitted back in 2017. It's now kind of joined the ECOWAS community again, and they've now really started to embrace their African identity. They haven't been completely embraced by their African brothers and sisters in other countries. A lot of that relates to what they've done before, not hosting the African Nations Cup because of Ebola fears, the Western Sahara issue. But if we follow the money, we can see significant progress in terms of what Morocco is doing in terms of trying to build this conduit play between the Arab world, Europe, and Africa, and become a gateway of sorts.
Sure.
In terms of intra-Africa investment, the numbers are rising quite dramatically. Atijari Wafa Bank has expanded aggressively in West Africa. Royal Air Maroc has expanded their connectivity quite significantly. The regional gas pipeline to Nigeria is something that is increasing connectivity. It's a big infrastructure play, and it's really generating a lot of interest amongst investors, both local and foreign.
Yeah, the play then hopefully is the sustainability of those projects, right? Everybody sort of getting involved. And as you made note, the ECOWAS region really beginning to, I suppose, embrace it a little bit more, hopefully, as time goes on as well. Let's come back a little bit closer to home. Post-election priorities for Mozambique. A lot has to be done for that country.
Yeah, so, you know, it's Filipe Nyusi's second term. Yeah. The parliamentarians were inaugurated yesterday. He's being inaugurated on the 15th, which is what, tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, that country has been struggling for quite a while. I think they've got four real key policy priorities or key areas that they need to address. The election result was pretty lopsided, so we'll need to watch the re-emergence of tensions between Frelimo and Renamo and how that plays out. The Islamic insurgency in the country is quite significant as well. Mm-hmm. Of course, the economy has been devastated because of the climatic factors. We remember Tropical Cyclone Idai last year.
Yes.
And then from my perspective, just looking at the economy, this hidden debt scandal and how this plays out is going to be really interesting, because you know, the policymakers lack credibility at the moment. Yeah. You've got the Manuel Chang extradition case. How will that be resolved? Will he go to the US? They need the IMF back in as a policy anchor, but there needs to be accountability. So lots of moving parts in Mozambique. Significant political, economic, and security challenges, and hopefully things will turn for the better in 2020.
We can certainly hope. Ronak, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. But on this Tuesday evening there, that's Ronak Gopaldas, of course, director and Africa analyst at Signal Risk, joining us in studio for our Africa Business Focus.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
All right, so 23 minutes to go then until the top of the hour. And we're on to our How It Works feature then this Tuesday evening. And we're lucky to be joined by Martha Smith, the lawyer and partner in the Life Sciences Group at Fasken. Now, joining us this time to perhaps chat about the current status of the legalization of cannabis and CBD products in South Africa. Now, this one has always been of keen question and keen understanding, I suppose, for many South Africans, trying to understand exactly what legislation has said, where you can keep it, where you can grow it, personal use, what doesn't constitute as personal use. Let's perhaps try and get the basics then, Martha. Good evening to you.
Thank you so much, Rabili. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah. So what are the actual basics then? What are you allowed to have, not allowed to have? What does the law actually say around cannabis use?
Okay, so the first thing to understand is you have recreational use of cannabis and you have medicinal use of cannabis. And from the onset, if you understand the difference between the two, you should be fine.
Sure.
So recreational use, as we know, that is where you use it in your own private capacity. You can grow it. Those things relate to the Constitutional Court judgment that was handed down on September 2018. And what that basically entails is that you can, as an adult, grow in your own private environment, in your house, in your home. You can grow cannabis. You can use that cannabis for your own personal consumption. And you're allowed then to be in possession of that cannabis as an adult for recreational purposes.
Sure.
Okay. We'll get to some of the details on that a bit later.
Okay. Because I think those will be some details that maybe some people are looking for. But yeah, sure.
And so what happened is after that judgment came out, the Department of Health, the Minister of Health, and SAHPRA, the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, they brought out some changes to how CBD is actually scheduled. So just rewinding a bit, you get CBD and THC, who are both components of a cannabis plant.
Okay.
So you have a lot of different derivatives. You have many compounds. There's hundreds of compounds within cannabis plants. THC and CBD being two of the cannabinoids that you find in a cannabis plant in different percentages.
Okay.
Okay. And so generally when we speak of medicinal cannabis, we are referring to THC in the high concentrations used as a Schedule 7 medication brought into the country or used on specific basis. So you need licenses for this stuff.
Yeah.
CBD is the more recent change that I think sparked a lot of interest within this cannabis industry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of it sort of being used, whether it be in your vaping as well, where a lot of people are kind of adding it to that. But CBD can also be used in some form of medicinal form, is it?
Of course. And so that is why the change that I'm talking about that came after the Constitutional Court judgment made it possible for people to more broadly and more easily access CBD. They changed the scheduling of CBD from Schedule 7 to Schedule 4.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Which means still on prescription, depending on what the THC dosages are. But there is also an exemption that was brought out. And in terms of this exemption, if you adhere to the requirements, being you shouldn't advocate that it is low risk, you shouldn't make any claims for it to be low risk use, or that it has any, you know, you shouldn't say it has medicinal healing properties.
Okay.
That's the one requirement. The other is that if you have a CBD product that has 0.001% THC or less, or 0.0075% CBD or less in that product, the basic compound of it, you don't actually have to register it as a medicine, and it can be sold freely on the market. You can import it into the country and you can sell it.
So effectively, are you saying that everything that perhaps is being used, and as I mentioned, vape or perhaps in ointments or whatever the case might be, that probably has 0.0075% of CBD, means that that's how they're able to sell it out on the street. So it has a very minute element of CBD.
Very small. And so important to note that most of the things, I shouldn't say most of, a lot of them have in the meantime been, you know, brought into what the exemption requires. But a lot of online purchases and things that are available currently and have been in the past do not necessarily adhere or conform to this requirement, unfortunately. Mm. And you can understand why, because the industry moves at a pace much faster than legislature and government can, number one.
Okay.
And number two, people have been selling CBD for years.
Yes.
Okay. This is not a it's not a new market. This regulation came out and the exemption came out, which kind of more put into a clear picture what is acceptable for the regulator.
Sure.
But you still have people selling this product, importing it. I mean, how many people I've spoken to say, well, I've been ordering it from the Netherlands for the past 5 years.
Sure.
It's not new. We are at a stage in our current situation and in the cannabis industry in South Africa where I would say the regulators saying, listen, we're aware of the changes. We are aware that industry is moving forward. There is also a need for this product.
Sure.
And we need to address it. So in bringing out the exemption, they're trying to address the need, but making an assumption that everything that's out there adheres to the exemption and the requirements from that, you know, we are still struggling with how to deal with actually moving to companies who are legitimately selling the product, adheres to their requirements, and then booming companies who've been selling this stuff for years in, you know, dosages and percentages much higher than what is legally allowed.
Yeah. So it does make it a bit of a scary one. How do you know in terms of legality, you know, as you said, how much is legal, how much whether one has been registered or not registered, and the one you take in, which may still be sold on the open market somehow, is still also right for you in that sense?
That's the hardest thing to determine. So I've had this conversation with, you know, my colleagues and people that I work closely with on cannabis, so often saying, we don't even know. They could be giving you cooking oil and putting it in, you know, a bottle that says CBD oil.
That's right, yeah.
You know, because the problem also is with the exemption that applies to these percentages. Once you make the claim and that is what they say, The process of actually testing whether or not that is in there is not present. When you register a new product, at any point where you send in a product to be registered fully with SAHPRA, that product is reviewed, it goes undergoes many tests. They check basically everything, your dosage, what did the composition is, everything gets checked out. But when you fall under the exemption, if you claim that, and you import it and you put a label on something that says this is, you know, 0.01% THC, there's no way for us to know if that's actually correct.
Sure.
Because it's under the exemption, it doesn't need to be registered.
Yeah.
And so it's imported, it's put on the market, and it's sold, and you're holding your thumbs.
And so even if, for example, it was to be tested initially as a starting base, and then ultimately that product then changed or tweaked in any other way in future, you wouldn't really know, and you'd have no recourse really for it.
And that is, good manufacturing practices are required for products that are manufactured and registered. But we're going from an assumption here. So as well, CBD products in the UK, for example, are seen as a health supplement. It's a supplement. It's not a medicine. They don't register it. So you import a product from the UK where, you know, it doesn't need to be registered. It is a health supplement. They have requirements for health supplements, but that doesn't speak to what our requirements in South Africa are for CBD, because they, you know, fundamentally different. It's not clear, you know, certain aspects and certain types of products for CBD can be seen as a supplement. And SAHPRA has brought out a new document saying, you know, here is some information. Some things can be seen as a supplement, but the dosages and the percentages of THC and CBD in products essentially determine what kind of a product it's going to be.
I suppose it's quite interesting then to try and figure out just how much you need, just what it is exactly as well that you're kind of taking in, right? And that'll be a key question as well. But Martha Smith, we are going to continue the conversation right after this as well, then really just on the how it works features, just a current status of the legalization of cannabis. Many people perhaps thinking they could just grow farms and farms and farms of this thing, and just how much of that is perhaps legally allowed. We'll chat to Martha Smith about that right after this.
702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
So if you've ever wanted to find out about the legalization of cannabis and CBD products, well, that's what we're doing now. How does it work? Martha Smith, the lawyer and partner at the Life Sciences Group at Fasken, joins us as well. Then we were talking before the break just really around how things work when it comes to this, what people, I suppose, can use it for in many instances. Now, just, you know, we keep getting a sense, or I've really engaged with a few people who think, you know, I could pretty much grow a whole garden of cannabis and really just grow it for my own private use then. And that's okay. And then afterwards they look to sell it off or give it off to friends and whatnot. That becomes the big problem, doesn't it?
Yeah, that becomes a huge problem. I have people calling me going, I have this idea. And after 5 minutes of the conversation, I say to them, please don't repeat this to anyone because you're going to go to jail. And this is the important thing for me, is education on what the difference is. So yes, you can grow it, you can smoke it, you can roll it, whatever you want to do in your own home as an adult. When you grow it and you want to be smart, and this was put to me by one of our candidate attorneys who said, well, what if I want to gift it to my friend for his birthday? I've grown it in my house and now I'm just giving it as a friend. And I said to them, well, you know, there we're going into very dark waters, because you can't sell it in terms of the Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act. You would be a drug dealer if you sell that cannabis to someone. Giving it as a gift, I think that would be a bit sneaky and dangerous. The police has a very wide berth on how to interpret the situation at the moment. The reason for that being because of so much uncertainty. If you're caught in possession of something and it's not yours, you didn't grow it, they're immediately going to ask you, where did you get it? And subsequently, somebody's going to get in trouble. So you can grow it, you can use it for yourself. Then the second part of that, people who go, I'm going to grow this, and then, as an example that happened here in South Africa not too long ago, I'm going to sell it in my little shop. And I'm going to write a note that says, you know, just put whatever you will pay for this here. So I'm not selling it to you. You're just donating an amount, and you can take a bag and walk out of the door.
Oh, wow.
that person got arrested. You can't do that, because whether or not you have, you know, the there's a mutual agreement of you have to put money here for you to take that.
Yes.
So you're still selling the product. Whatever sure. the person's giving you is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
And that's what people need to understand. You can have it, but you can't suddenly jump from recreational use and growing it for your own use into becoming a commercial seller mm-hmm. of the product.
So is there a regulation as to how much of it you can grow in your own garden, for example? I mean, if I owned a couple of hectares and I decided to do it for myself and that was my yard space, my home and my own private use, would that still be okay?
That is what we don't know. When sure. the judgment from the Constitutional Court came out, it basically dropped this bomb and said, it's now legal in terms of the right to privacy. You can use it. You have to be an adult. And Parliament is tasked to come up with how they're going to do this. So they're given 2 years from the date of September 2018, which means September this year. Mm. We need to know. But the judgment says nothing else. It's silent.
Sure.
And so if you grow it in excessive amounts in your backyard, at the moment, how much can one person use? If you want to go about it logically, the police might say, well, you're one guy living here, you're one person, you can't possibly grow 5 tons of this stuff.
Sure.
There's no way that you would be able to use that up, mm. you know, reasonably.
I suppose
I'm sure there would be people.
Yeah, but the person who gets caught would kind of set the precedent at
exactly,
that point, right? Because
exactly.
then case law would,
exactly. would have be, to have
that
them
case
in court.
Would be the case law.
Yes.
Okay. Now, with us getting educated in all of this, the people that also need to get educated in all of it are doctors, right? Because offering it somehow as medicinal use is also increasing, and that needs to be well done by doctors.
Yes. So in our current situation, doctors who want to prescribe this product, a CBD or a THC-containing product for a patient, can do so, but they have to have a special license from SAHPRA that authorizes them to be a doctor prescribing cannabis products. And then they have to apply under what we call a Section 21 application in terms of Section 21 of the Act to say this product is not registered, because there's no registered cannabis medicine in South Africa. None, not one cannabis medicine has been registered in South Africa. Everything that doctors are prescribing and that's coming in for medicinal use are actually imported from other countries under this Section 21 application. And so you have to have a license as a doctor to prescribe it.
Mm.
Then you have to have the Section 21 application where you have to specify why you want to treat your patient with this product.
So is it a different registration in terms of, for the doctor that is, that
yes.
they need to have a special kind of permit or authority
yes.
or whatever it is in order to be able to sell it?
Yes. For them to actually be able to import it, because what happens is they import the product.
Yeah.
They have to have a license to dispense, so they have to be able to dispense the
sure.
product to the patient, and that's where the patient gets that product from. Or the doctor gives the prescription to the patient, who then goes to what we call an authorized pharmacy. So the pharmacist who actually gets the product in and provides it to the patient also has to have a specific license from SAHPRA to do that. It's highly regulated.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So we clearly have a few people who didn't know any of all of this. And I suppose the significant elements are that how you get it right is by educating yourself. How much more information is there out there on all of this stuff? Is it readily available? Is it possible for people to just, you know, go onto a particular website and just read up on all of this and get a firmer understanding?
I would say, if you'd asked me this question about 6 months ago, I would have said no.
Mm.
Since the exemption came out, that came out and the scheduling document was gazetted, it came out. And then there was pure silence. There are guidelines that SAHPRA has published.
Sure.
Specifically, the latest one that was brought out last year deals with your license application to cultivate, manufacture, import, export cannabis. And that document is available for the purpose of growing it for CBD purposes commercially, being able to cultivate the product, to manufacture the product, and
yes.
then make the CBD oil for medicinal purposes.
Sure.
But other than that, a general information document had not really been around until December of last year. at the end, I always say, so it came out right at the end of the year when nobody properly was reading it. But there's an information document that's, I think, quite well put together that SAPRA, the regulator, brought out. And it really gives a good basic understanding of what you can and cannot do, what is recreational use, what is legal, what is CBD, how does it work? Edibles, for example, is a big question. When can I eat something that's got CBD in it? Or, you know, those kinds of things. They're addressing it. It's a basic understanding of it. But for someone who wants to know more and make sure they don't go to jail in the way that they're using the product or accessing the product, that would be a very good place to start.
Feel like changes are coming, though, with regards to how it's used. As you said a little bit earlier, 2018 was when a part of this was gazetted and laid out as well. We were given 2 years to sort of look into this legislation. That means September this year we're supposed to get some sort of word. Do you feel like we're getting there and that Parliament is perhaps looking at it in any way? Or do you feel like it's perhaps going to go through quite a bit of a delay still before we get any sort of notion and updates?
So I have some information that there has been interest by different groupings within government, you know, different departments who have been looking into and extending their hand of, you know, requesting information on how things were done, for example, in Canada. Because Canada is basically the flagship for all other countries trying to legalize it for recreational use and also still having a very nice medicinal aspect to the industry. And I know that government is behind closed doors. They are working. How Parliament is going to address it, we have no idea. But the departments within government that... you know, have something to say about it. They have people that are interested in stepping up here and that are working on stuff as we speak.
Martha, really, really appreciate it. I really hope we've educated quite a few people and given insights, notions, thoughts. And hopefully this does grow high on our agenda, right? It becomes a little bit more significant to all the lawmakers as well. Martha Smith is lawyer and partner in the Life Sciences Group at Fasken, really talking about the legalization of cannabis and CBD products in South Africa. Thank you so much for that. That does bring us to the end of the Money Show as well this evening. Bruce Whitfield is indeed back with you tomorrow. This does bide my time. I'll see you again, or rather, you'll hear me again on Monday morning or Monday afternoon, should I say, for the Money Show as well.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP.